consistent reports from witnesses to the effect that people who acted as though they were in a kind of trance were killing and eating their victims prompted authorities to examine the bodies of some of the victims. Medical authorities in Cumberland have concluded that in all cases, the killers are eating the flesh of the people they murdered.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Every dead body that is not exterminated becomes one of them. It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill.
There's no more room in hell. The dead walk here.
Bang! Your game!
Welcome everybody back to the special Romero Detrospective Edition
of
DeadDead.com. And I am Uncle Bill.
And I'm a creep Kentuckian, if you will.
And this week, in lieu of our normal show where we do the news and reviews and, you know, fan mail section, we're going to be doing a retrospective of George Romero's dead films.
For the finale of May of the Dead. We thought since it's a finale, we had to get somebody big for the show. And I know over the past 2 weeks we've been hinting at somebody that we've been trying and trying and trying to get. But we talked to this somebody last night for the interview today on the show. We have
Tom Savini.
The legendary makeup effects man turned actor turned director now.
Call him Blades, call him Sex Machine, call him the King of Splatter, call him what you will.
Yeah, but he has been involved in many, many Romero films. I know that he was originally slated to do Night of Living Dead, mm-hmm. and later directed the remake of Night of Living Dead. And we also got, I thought I would add this in because I found another cool clip from the Gary Clark interview that I want to play a little later. It's a couple of clips that we're going to play. But, yeah, this show is going to be different than normal. I mean, it's going to be all Romero's dead movies. We're going to discuss them all. We're going to discuss what we like about them, what we don't like about them, how they changed the genre.
Basically, what we're going to do is just bullshit a lot about films.
Yeah, I mean,
it's nothing really formal or anything. So.
Yeah, and it's nothing we have planned. We don't have anything written out. We don't have anything typed out.
Yeah.
It's just how we feel about these movies. But before we get into talking about Night of Living Dead, I guess we can talk about how George Romero's films influenced everybody in the genre throughout the years.
Well, before Night of Living Dead, as most people know, zombies per se were mostly Caribbean-based, and they weren't cannibalistic, for one thing. They mostly murdered people with, you know, tools or their hands or something like that, but they weren't, you know, cannibals up until...
Yeah, one early example of a zombie movie, White Zombie, which had Bela Lugosi in it, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and it's nothing like Romero's zombies. And at the time when Night of the Living Dead came out, there was no other film remotely like that. So he could be one of the only people alive that actually started the whole genre of films,
yeah.
George Romero did.
According to legend, I think it was Marilyn Eastman, Carl Hardman, Russ Dryden, and Romero were all sitting around, and just to try to figure out something that would absolutely shock people the most so they could get the most audience and the most publicity for the film Night of the Living Dead, they came up with the cannibal gimmick, which every zombie since then, you know, basically is used.
Yeah, but I know George Romero, he was just a small independent filmmaker from New York, mm-hmm. originally, that did commercials. I know that there's some commercials, like a laundry detergent and stuff like that, that's on, I think it's actually on one of those DVDs that we got here. But he was doing stuff like that. Night of the Living Dead happened to be his first ever full-length film.
It was. There was some, he made some little, like, student film before that or something. I can't remember. Well, it wasn't a student film, but it was like an art film, but I can't remember what it was now.
Yeah.
But Night of the Living Dead, there's, like, so many different stories about that movie. Because basically what Night of the Living Dead was is what independent cinema was in the 80s and what it kind of still is now, which was just a group of people that knew each other that got together and pulled their money and resources and got loans and made a film that they all believed in. It had nothing to do with studios, and much of Romero's stuff didn't have.
And a lot of the people that were in the movie, starring in the movie, weren't really actors. They were just people that George knew. I know Judith O'Day was an actor, and obviously Dwayne Jones was an actor. He was probably the best actor in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure Carl Harbin, Marilyn Eastman, they weren't actresses.
No. Russ Striner and John Russo, I'm pretty sure that Romero recruited both of them.
Yeah, and I know that Judy Ridley...
she was Carl Harbin's secretary, I think. Or,
She was also married to Russ Striner, too. Mm-hmm. I know that. I don't know if they were married before then or after then, but they were married. And, yeah, I mean, I think the only two actors in the movie was Judith O'Day and Dwayne Jones. Which is pretty amazing, actually. I mean, I know that movie gets a lot of flack for being, you know, a lot of bad acting in it, supposedly. But
yeah, but nobody in that movie were really, like you were saying, actors,
yeah,
per se.
Which is really amazing.
See, that was the point. The true point of any kind of independent film, which is what that was at the time, was not the acting. It was to make something completely different that would shake things up and make people, you know, want to see the film.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what he did. And, you know, to Romero's credit, and I said this before, I think that he did the most with the least amount of money that he had. I mean, most of that, from what I read, most of that movie was financed by Russ Striner. And it was taken, like, through his father. His father loaned him most of the money.
Yeah.
I think he has a producer credit on the film, too. And that's where they got the majority of the money. And I know that I'd heard a story that he won a lot of the sound editing by playing a game of chess with the sound editor.
Yeah.
From the film, and it's just different, you know, different things like that. That movie was shoestring budget, and for it to come together as well.
And it just goes to show you, I mean, we've talked to a lot of independent filmmakers out there. You don't need a lot of money to make a great film.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the classic examples right here.
And one thing that movie doesn't have that a lot of people think it has, along with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is a lot of explicit gore. It really, you know.
Yeah, and even if it does have a lot of gore, it really doesn't matter because it's shot. It's black and white. Everybody knows it's in black and white.
Yeah. I think the extent of the gore is that they show a couple of bones and
I think it's chicken bones and stuff like that.
And Savini, of course, we talked to him about this in the interview. He didn't have anything to do with the effects in the film. But you can almost imagine that it wouldn't have mattered if he did since it was in black and white.
And I know they used Bosco chocolate syrup for the blood. Which is probably, for black and white, it'd probably be the most realistic you could use. But it's sort of funny if you think about it.
But, okay, if for people out there that don't know what the film is about, and I can't imagine somebody that wouldn't, but...
Yeah, I mean, if you're anywhere in the United States, you can probably find this DVD from $1 to $5 at any store.
And one of the other things that's so amazing about this, and kind of sad about this film, is that it's not under any kind of copyright now, so anybody in there...
There's like, 20-some companies that has these out on DVD.
But the basic plot of the film, a brother and sister go to a graveyard.
And you've probably heard the opening segment from Hillbilly Horror Theater last week, the opening 5 minutes or so.
And while they're there, just inexplicably, they are attacked by like a ghoul. The sister runs to the house, who's played by Judith O'Day, runs to a farmhouse, and she meets up with Dwayne Jones' character, Ben, and, the two characters that are in the basement along with their daughter. And basically the whole rest of the movie is them trying to fight off approaching ghouls. They don't call them zombies in the film. They just call them things and ghouls.
I don't really understand why everybody doesn't think this is a zombie movie. It's a ghoul movie simply because... they don't say the word zombie in it. Why do you need somebody telling you what it is? Who gives a fuck? It's the same rules that was in the other films.
You don't need somebody telling you what it is, but, you know, people need shit to bitch about, so that's why you get stuff like that.
It's not a ghoul film, it's a zombie film, so go fuck yourself if you think it's a ghoul film.
That's right. To me, the best part about this film was the fact that it not only did it introduce a whole new genre of, you know, or subgenre of film, but the ending to the film was not a happy ending. It was a bleak ending.
Yeah.
And it was, in that regard, it probably influenced more films than just the fact that it was about, you know, zombies.
Yeah. I know that we talked to Judith O'Day about, you know, some of the subtle backstories that Romero has gotten famous for now, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, and I sort of agree with you, that he really didn't, you know, expect that in the first one. I don't think it was intended.
Romero said in an interview I read one time that he, if anything in that movie had any kind of social, you know, relevance, it was purely by accident. And he was just trying to make a movie that, you know, would shock people and make a little bit of money so he could go on to make other movies. He wasn't really trying to make any kind of statement. Now, what happened is, and I've talked to people that, you know, basically write theses about this movie, is people, you know, picked up on the fact that there was a lead character that was a black guy and there was a lead character that was a woman and just ran with it because at that time there wasn't that many films like it. Just don't think about it that damn much. I mean, there's people out there that do that. Just leave it alone. Leave it. I mean, it's a fucking great movie. It doesn't have to be all this stuff that people try to make it out to be.
Well, I think that's, again, though, that's a fun thing that people like that can do for movies that really don't explain themselves that much.
Well, he did leave a lot up to the, you know, imagination, but I just get tired of hearing everybody and their fucking grandma's opinion about what every scene in this movie meant. I don't give a shit. It's like the people that play, you know, Dark Side of the Moon alongside the Wizard of Oz and talk about that shit. I don't give a flying shit about any of that stuff. I just think it was a great movie. And, you know, if you want to talk about movies that, with the, you know, social commentary, move on to something like Dawn of the Dead, where he actually knew what he was doing and tried to make the movie that way.
Well, you could clearly tell. Yeah. But I think it says something, though, for Night of the Living Dead, that it's been nearly 40 years since that movie was made. And, you know, people still watch it today. It's still on TV. Every Halloween you'll see it. And there's only a handful of movies you can say that for, actually. Mm-hmm.
It is. It's a classic. It sets standard for everything that comes out today, basically, in zombie films.
Yeah. So, let's move on to what would probably be the most popular of all Romero's dead films, at least for our generation, I think.
Yeah, moving on to Dawn of the Dead.
Which came out roughly 10 years after Night of the Living Dead.
And in between there, Romero made, I think it was a movie called There's Always Vanilla and Martin. And Martin's not that bad of a movie. It's definitely worth picking up.
Never seen There's Always Vanilla, though.
Yeah. But Dawn of the Dead.
I hear it's not too good.
Dawn of the Dead is, in a lot of people's opinion, Romero's, like, masterpiece. He'll probably never be able to top it no matter what he does because there's so many people that consider that to be a classic zombie film.
And a lot of us, too, that were around that age, I know that we were both born in 1980. So, you know, the film was very popular on video when we were kids. So, you know, but honestly, for me, I know that you grew up watching all the time. I really didn't get the movie entirely until I was probably about 15 or 16 years old.
Yeah, it was just around so much that I'd seen it so many times when I was a kid that the thing that impressed me the most about it at the time was actually Savini's makeup effects. Because when you're a kid, you don't pay any attention to plot or storyline. But the, you know, the exploding heads and, you know, squib stuff that he did in that movie.
Yeah, which is, which really, I mean, it's basically just a showcase of different ways to kill zombies. You know, it has all that in it that really you didn't have in Night of the Living Dead.
The thing about that movie that always amazed me was the fact that they took a cast of people, and they did this in Night of the Living Dead, but even more so in Dawn of the Dead, because these people could actually really act, that were completely unknown, and for the most part are unknown today.
Except at conventions.
Yeah.
They all seem to do conventions.
And put them all together, and I'd say, and I still say this today, that Scott Reiniger's role in that film was probably one of my favorite all-time, you know, portrayals by anybody in any film. I just thought that he really did a great job in that movie. But the point is that they took a cast of unknowns and made a film that was infinitely better than all those films that came out around the time that had, you know, like one big star in it, you know, with The Omen, and Gregory Peck, and, you know, just different movies like that. And they made an incredibly entertaining movie that way. And now the other big part of that was Savini and the way that he revolutionized splatter effects in the movie.
I think, too, a lot of the movies don't have this element to it. I thought Dawn of the Dead was a horror movie, but it was also sort of like an adventure movie.
Yeah, it was. It had a lot of different... It was almost like a bunch of different movies put into one thing.
You know, or like a quest. They're on a quest, you know, to find a holdout to where they can get away from these zombies. And it just happens to be an indoor shopping mall, which was a fairly new thing in 1978 or so, whenever they were filming it. And I really couldn't think of a better idea for a zombie movie than that. It's really cool.
It's almost like it mixes a biker movie with the old high seas pirate movies, because they come in and they storm the compound, and it's almost like that's their treasure. They try to hold on to it for as long as they can, and of course in the end somebody comes over and overtakes them.
Yeah.
And so it's just it combines a lot of those elements, those different films that I'd say Romero probably
grew up watching.
Another
thing that's different from Night of the Living Dead is the score by Goblin.
Yeah, that was probably the first time I ever noticed a film that actually benefited from the musical cues.
Yeah. And that's probably one of the best Goblin scores, and they have a bunch. They have a great discography, I guess you would say. But, yeah, I mean, the music, it was the first zombie movie that used the bass drum that I can remember. Boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. Like that. And it just creates great atmosphere. I was watching the movie the other night, though, and another thing that I thought it did really well, in the very beginning, it just created the chaos atmosphere very well, you know, when they're at the TV station and, you got David Crawford and David Early arguing back and forth, you know, about what's going on. You have Galen Ross behind the camera waiting on David MG's character.
One of the big things that I think that in that regard they took from Night of the Living Dead that was so effective was the realism of the radio broadcast that were in Night of the Living Dead, you know, where the guy came on and said, you know, this is hard to believe, but apparently the dead are returning to life. And it was that kind of thing that made it seem like it could happen, and that you were there, and that, you know, at any time your TV could come on, and this kind of epidemic could. Plus, they never explained in Night of the Living Dead, or even in Dawn of the Dead, and they never really tried to explain what caused, you know, They had all the experts that would come on there, but they never explained what caused it. They were just explaining how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of made it, you know.
And then you had all the zombies, and you had tons more zombies in Dawn of the Dead than you had in Night of the Living Dead. You had the Hare Krishna zombie. Mm-hmm. You had the nurse zombie, which does conventions. She still does conventions.
You had characters. I think that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, it was everyday people that you would see around that time were zombies.
Well, this is also in the Savini interview, and I didn't ever really think about it this way, but this has to be one of the first films where they just sat down and said, let's see if we can come up with the most gruesome ways we can think of to kill people.
Yeah.
Because that's what the movie plays like.
Yeah, and some of the first gut-ripping scenes, and I don't know if it was the first.
Yeah, you mentioned that there are scenes like that in, what was it?
Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, gut-ripping scenes. But you had that in a lot more gruesome fashion. You had a lot more blood in this. The death scenes is really what makes this a lot more hardcore than Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, well, it got an X rating. Yeah. So, I mean, initially upon its release. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, Romero at the time was approached by a studio, I think I read, and he said, you know, if he could trim off 4 or 5 minutes off the film, they would give an R rating, and he basically just told them to go fuck themselves, and he would leave it at his is and, you know, take the X. Which you have to respect that. I mean, Romero, if you read any interview with him, he absolutely hates the studio system in Hollywood. And I don't think there's many people left like that. I mean, Carpenter's not like that. Carpenter bought into the system after a while, and so did Craven. I mean, they bought into it wholeheartedly.
Craven definitely did, didn't he?
Yeah. And Romero was one of the few holdouts who actually just did these, you know, kind of independent, family-oriented, not family-oriented in that sense, but, you know, where the crew was like a family.
Yeah, and if you go back to the original script from Dawn of the Dead, or at least one of the original scenes that was never shot, the ending of Dawn of the Dead, Galen Ross's character was supposed to kill herself. It was supposed to be a dark ending, too. But I think Romero, I read somewhere, he mentioned in an interview one time that he chose to change it because of Night of the Living Dead. Everybody, you know, was sort of, he thought everybody might have expected that ending anyway, and he changed it and had Ken Foree and Galen Ross's character survive.
Yeah, and in the first one, he didn't give much hope, you know, for mankind. And in Dawn of the Dead, that was kind of his whole point of that ending, was the fact that, you know, Galen Ross's character was pregnant and humanity would live on, I guess, you know.
If you will. So, I guess we can go to the first part of the Tom Savini interview that we did yesterday.
This is the first part he will talk about, you know, his association with Romero and how he, the Night of the Living Dead, and he almost got the role for Night of the Living Dead, do the effects work. And, of course, he talked about Dawn of the Dead. So,
yeah, he talks about everything. We actually had a pretty good long interview with him, so.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, the interview you thought you would never hear.
Yeah, I certainly didn't think I'd ever hear it.
Only on deadbit.com.
I guess the first question would, of course, be how you became involved with the effects industry and just the entertainment industry in general.
Well, I saw a movie when I was 11 called Man of a Thousand Faces. It was a story of Lon Chaney, who was the Phantom of the Opera. His son was the Wolfman, and I have my own son whose name is Lon, and I just flipped out because it was a story of Lon Chaney, a makeup artist, an actor, a stuntman, and I wanted to be all those things. So I learned makeup by, you know, reading library books, and was lucky enough to, after buying materials, getting local jobs for commercials, and then having a portfolio that I would put in front of people like George Romero who would hire me, and then the rest is history. I just kept getting hired.
Around that time, was there anybody in particular that influenced you as an artist or as a filmmaker?
Yeah, sure. Dick Smith. Dick Smith is probably the greatest living makeup artist on the planet. He did The Godfather, The Exorcist, Midnight Cowboy, The Sentinel, Amadeus. And he was the only guy that would share his secrets. So you could call Dick up and ask him, how do you make blood? And he'd tell you. Nobody else would tell you stuff like that. And I have a school. I have a school, a special makeup effects school here in Pittsburgh, and Dick Smith is part of it now. So, but Dick Smith, guys like Jack Pierce, who created Frankenstein and the Wolfman, guys like Rick Baker, you know, who did American Werewolf in mm-hmm. London, all the great makeup artists were idols of mine, and when their movies came out, it was like going to see the exhibit from your favorite artist.
We were just curious how you first met George Romero and what that experience was like.
I was in high school. I was a sophomore in high school, and George Romero came to my high school to cast a couple of young kids. And I was the only one he picked out of my high school and had a screen test, and the movie was never made. Then years later, he was doing Night of the Living Dead, and I went down and told him that I do effects and makeup, and he said, yeah, we can use you on this, but then I had enlisted in the Army, and they took me before George got to shoot the movie, so I was actually in Vietnam when George shot Night of the Living Dead. But then when I came back, I went back to his office because he was getting ready to do Martin. Mm-hmm. I wanted to play the vampire, but it was already cast. But, you know, I told him I showed him my portfolio, and he hired me, and I wound up doing the effects, the stunts, and playing a part on Martin. And then, you know, we got Dawn of the Dead, and I did Friday the 13th right after Dawn of the Dead, and I took a leave of absence from college to do Dawn of the Dead. And I haven't been back since because I've been working.
Yeah. Being that this is a kind of like a Romero tribute, I was wondering what your first impressions of Romero were when you met him.
Well, he was just a big, jolly guy with a beard and a great laugh and a great sense of humor, and those qualities stayed the same working with him, only, you know, more so. He was more fun to be with, and we kind of had a secret language of our own using sound effects, you know, on stage, on locations. And he, as an actor or as a makeup guy, he would let you improvise. So, you know, we came up with half of the shit that was in those movies ourselves. We'd just go to George and say, how about if we do this? How about if we kill a guy with a screwdriver? And he would just go, uh-huh. And then we would just do it, you know.
I was kind of curious about in Dawn of the Dead, how much of the input Romero had on the way the zombies looked.
Well, don't forget, now, Dawn of the Dead was a sequel to Night of the Living Dead. Night of the Living Dead was a black and white movie, so we just decided to make the zombies gray, you know. Although they didn't photograph that way. Sometimes they photograph blue, green, depending on the light, fluorescent lights, you know. But that was really it, just to make them all the same color so you knew what a zombie was. And as far as the deaths go, I was doing a play in North Carolina, and George sent me a telegram before Dawn of the Dead that said, we got another gig, start thinking of ways to kill people. So, I mean, that was it. So, you know, we came up with lots of ways to kill people, and he would just let us do it.
So, the, for instance, the clay man scene and the machete zombie scene, that was all stuff that you basically improvised on set?
No, which one?
The clay man scene is a scene in the apartment complex where the head explodes.
Oh yeah, that was I think we came up with that and decided on how to do it. In fact, the head that explodes is really Galen Ross's head, the blonde that starred in the movie.
Yeah, for instance.
Because there was originally going to be a sad ending where she kills herself by jumping in the helicopter blade, so that's why we cast her head. So when George decided to do a happy ending, we still had Galen's head around, so I put afro hair on it and, you know, made it dark, and she became the head that we exploded in the projects. And the machete guy, that was just something we invented and then had to think of a way to do it. And we just picked a guy off the crew, Lenny Lees, and, you know, did a reverse shot of the machete coming out of his head, and that became the effect.
Now, there's a ton of extras on Dawn of the Dead. I was just curious, like, what was a typical day like in the makeup department of that film?
Well, when you when you're born in Pittsburgh, one of the things you want to be when you grow up is a zombie in a Romero movie, you know. So there was no difficulty getting zombies. You simply put an ad in the paper, and they all showed up. And a typical day was showing up at the mall around 7 o'clock, going into the community room, which is like a big waiting area that they had there, and we just slap on the gray makeup on. I had an assistant who would help me slap gray makeup on. But when there were special zombies needed, you know, I had a bunch of friends from college that would come in for $25 a day and just put appliances on them and make them, you know, grislier than just plain old gray. And that didn't happen too often, but there were, and then they had box lunches, and we would watch Night of the Living Dead on the big TV in the community room or other movies. But, I mean, it was, you know, it's a lot of fun to do that, to hang out with, you know, go to lunch with a bunch of zombies, you know.
I know we talked to some people from Night of the Living Dead that they talked about chocolate syrup was the blood in that. And
in the original movie.
Yeah.
But, see, Alfred Hitchcock did that in Psycho as well.
Yeah, that's right.
The blood was just chocolate syrup.
The blood in Dawn of the Dead seemed to look like bright red paint.
Now, the blood in Dawn of the Dead was a travesty. I mean, it was a big mistake. It was made by the 3M company, you know, 3M copiers, 3M, you know, paper. They made a stage blood that looked great in the bottle.
Yeah.
But it photographed like melted crayons or something.
Yeah.
It was horrible. But it also, it helped take you away from the grisliness of the movie. It made it more comic book-like and made it more of a kind of a fantasy thing, you know. I mean, I wish it looked deep red, but that was before I learned Dick Smith's makeup, Dick Smith's blood formula, which we all use today.
Yeah, I think it's sort of like the Argento movie, some of that bright red.
Well, the problem in the Argento movies or in other movies like Identity or any movie where somebody's wearing a white shirt and the blood gets on it, it's a mistake by the makeup guys, because you're supposed to if it's going to go on something white, you have to add green to the blood, and then the blood stays deep red when it hits white material. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it looks like strawberry Kool-Aid or something, you know?
Yeah.
But that's just ignorance on the special makeup effects guys. I mean, we teach this in my school, that if the blood goes on something white, you have to add, for every gallon of red blood, you have to add 32 drops of green food coloring, mm-hmm. and that keeps the blood deep red when it hits white clothing.
Hmm. I guess out of all the movies, Dawn of the Dead pretty much influenced the splatter genre. And I was curious what you thought about all the Italian films that followed after that.
Well, I think I only saw one, and it was Zombie. And, and in those days, I looked at everything as an effects guy, and I loved Zombie because of the effects, the eyeball getting pulled onto the big wooden pointy splinter, you know,
yeah.
stuff was pretty damn cool. And that's what we were doing. We were creating unique ways to kill people, and they still haven't stopped doing that. You've got Hostel and Silent Hill and Wolf Creek and, you know, all these movies where they are just excuses to kill people, you know, in interesting ways. Final Destination. I mean, this is a formula that we began a long time ago, and it still works and still makes money today.
Exactly, which brings me to my next question, which is, speaking of coming up with interesting ways to kill people, how did you become involved with Friday the 13th?
It was Sean Cunningham who had seen Dawn of the Dead, and he called me, and I drove up to Connecticut and had a meeting with him, and we went through the effects list, and he actually did not have an ending for the movie in his script. I mean, he had the ending where, you know, the mother is killed and all that stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
but... we had just seen Carrie, you know, where the movie is over, you think, and Carrie, her friend is walking down the street and goes to Carrie's grave, and her hand comes out of the grave, which is a big surprise.
Yeah.
So we thought there should be a surprise ending, so I said Jason should come back and then come out of the lake or something, and they were like, well, how? Jason's dead. You know, no, you may, if you make the audience know that what they have just seen is a dream, then they will accept anything, you know. And that's how, you know, the ending came to be Jason coming out of the lake. We invented that. I invented that.
We talked to Harry Manfredini, who was the composer on the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he talked specifically about that ending and how he had to come up with the music that kind of, you know, led into tranquility right before the part where Jason comes up and attacks Adrian.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing in Carrie. The music at the end of Carrie makes you think the music, the movie is over and the credits are going to come up any second.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what Harry Manfredini did for Friday the 13th. When that music comes up, you clearly expect the credits to come up any second, and then here comes Jason, a big surprise, you know.
Now, did you create the look for the young Jason, or was there...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cunningham didn't have any particular way he wanted?
No, I kept thinking of this guy that I saw in my neighborhood when I was a kid. He had, you know, one ear was lower than the other, and I was kind of thinking of Quasimodo, the Hunchback of Notre Dame,
yeah.
with one eye being lower. You know, I just explained that to Sean, and originally Jason was bald, had hair, but I thought that he'd look creepier if he was bald, so we made him that way.
Yeah, I've read through the Crystal Lake Memories book, and I know that he declined the first two sequels and ended up doing The Burning, which is almost exactly like Friday the 13th. I was just curious why you were against doing 2 and 3.
Well, they sent me the script for 2, and they had Jason running around, and I said, what the hell are you guys doing? There's no Jason. Jason was a kid that died in the movie.
Yeah.
His mother was the killer. He says, no, we're going to change all that. Well, of course they didn't, you know. So I just thought it was stupid, so I chose to do The Burning instead, which was, as you said, the impression is that it's a Friday the 13th ripoff, but it was written before Friday the 13th and just wasn't produced.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because it was Miramax's first movie. You know, Miramax is like MGM today, you know, it's like
yeah.
a big deal. But the Weinstein brothers, that was their first movie, The Burning. So I chose to do that, and then they didn't, the Friday the 13th people didn't offer me part 3. I didn't turn it down, they didn't offer it to me. But they did offer me part 4. You know, I gave Jason birth in the first movie, so it was only fitting that I get to kill him in what was called the final chapter.
Yeah, I've always...
They really thought that was going to be the last movie, part four. But it made so much money that that's why I clearly realize and believe that there's going to be a Friday the 13th, part 13.
Yeah. I've always kind of wondered that because I'd always heard that the reason you came back for the fourth one was because they told you you could kill the character off. Is there any truth to that?
Well, it's a lot of things. I mean, Joe Zito directed part four, and he's the guy that I had worked for before, a director.
The Prowler?
The Prowler,
Invasion USA.
Invasion USA. I think we did that out. No, I thought we did those before, I think, Friday the 13th. I did Red Scorpion with him in Africa, so Friday the 13th. They had already hired Greg Canham to do the effects. And the crew was already there, and they had already started the movie. But Greg Canham had gone to England, just left, to go do the Ozzy Osbourne Werewolf album cover.
Bark at the Moon.
Yeah, so they fired him, and Joe Zito brought me in. And like I said, the crew had already been working. They had already started the look of Jason. They were simply going to make a 35-year-old version of what I had created in part one, you know. So that was part of it, that Joe Zito had hired me. The second part of it was that I didn't make hardly any money on Friday the 13th, part one. You know, all I wanted out of that movie was to get a big screen television, which I got. And but the movie made $72 million.
Yeah.
And the reviews all said that the star of the movie was Tom Savini's effects. And that sort of pissed me off, you know. I mean, I didn't make any money, and these guys made $72 million, and everyone thought the star of the movie, the reason for the movie's success was my effects, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked me on part four, I asked for an exorbitant amount of money, and I got it.
Shit.
So that's another reason why I did it, you know, also. And then the third reason, of course, is I got to kill Jason. And it's like the Frankenstein syndrome. I'm like Dr. Frankenstein. I created the monster, and I get to kill him, you know.
That's what I always thought, yeah.
Yeah.
But in between part one and part four, you have a ton of credits, but I just briefly want to touch on them. Maniac. Is there anything in particular you remember about that film?
I remember all of that film. I mean, I got to live in New York for 2 months. I got to meet Joe Spinell, who took me to meet Sylvester Stallone at Nighthawks. I met a girlfriend that was my girlfriend for a while after that film. And I got to do all those grisly, classic, I blew my own head off.
I know, that was probably my favorite effect in that movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a lot of fun in that movie, you know.
Also, The Prowler, which we...
The Prowler was Josie. You know, here's the thing. See, I left... I did Friday the 13th, and on the way home, I did Maniac in New York.
Yeah.
Then when that was over, I went down to Cape May and did The Prowler. You know, I was like going... I was on a steady stream there from one movie to another, just driving from one movie set to another movie set and creating the effects from scratch, you know?
So around
that's a lot of fun. That was like Halloween. That was like getting to open up your makeup kit and create monsters and grisly effects and get paid for it, you know. And then they become movies that come out with your name on it. I mean, even today I get lots of fan mail because these movies that we made 20, 30 years ago are just now even coming out on DVD, and it keeps your name alive, keeps your name out there, and it keeps your fans become kids of the next generation, you know. That's all the advantages of having done those films.
I'd like to welcome everyone back to deadpit.com for the Romero Dentrospective on me. The finale. So, yeah, that was part one of the Tom Savini interview. The second part will be a little bit later on. And we're also going to have another short clip from the Gary Clark interview that we did a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it all weaves itself together to kind of make sense. Goes along with Savini.
Yeah. So, I know that it took Romero another 8 years, 7-8 years, to work to completing Day of the Dead, which was the third installment of the original Romero trilogy, which I still consider that a trilogy myself.
The thing about Day of the Dead that's worth noting before we even start talking about it is that the movie that you see now is by no means the actual film that Romero wanted to make.
Yeah.
There was three or four different scripts for the film, I think.
I know the original script was, I think the movie was supposed to be nearly 3 hours long, if I remember. I'm not positive on that.
And also, the studio that, and I think, I'm not sure what the studio was. Was it Laurel at the time?
Yeah, with Richard P. Rubenstein.
Yeah, the studio at the time had said that, you know, they would give Romero a certain amount more money than what he
actually... Well, no, it wasn't the studio. It was one of the financial backers.
Well, yeah, but it was run through the studio, so it's the same damn thing. But if he could, you know, make the film a certain way and leave out a lot...
Well, what it was, he wanted an R rating.
Yeah. To put it simply, if he'd leave out a lot of the gore scenes in the film, just like with what happened with Dawn of the Dead and the X rating.
He would give him that to make that movie. So Romero wouldn't accept that, so he basically made the movie he wanted to make, and it was another one that was, I think it had an NC-17 rating, and they changed it at the time. It wasn't X anymore.
But point being, within the limitations of that budget, they had to scale down the production of the film considerably, so the film that he wanted to make, he didn't get to make.
Yeah.
Because, basically, he stuck to his principles, which is something you'll never see happen with filmmakers anymore these days.
Unfortunately not, no.
But in Day of the Dead... And I always thought this when I was a kid, but I guess it wasn't supposed to be that way. I thought that the cast Day of the Dead were the last remaining people in the world. And I always thought that, but, you know, with Land of the Dead, of course, that can't be. But you've got a small group of survivors, you know, some military soldiers and some scientists that live in this underground bunker. And it's basically they're trying to figure out a way to cure the disease that turns people into zombies.
Yeah.
And, of course, they don't get along well. And a lot of people...
Somebody that we talked to on the round table a few weeks ago. David Stagnari, about the acting.
Shit, you can read my mind. But, yeah, a lot of people think that the acting in the film was really over the top and way too much so. And people just... And I agree with kind of what I believe that Romero said that, at one time, people wanted another shopping mall, and, you know, it didn't happen that way, you know. So, what you're left with is a film that's a lot more confined, and there's not
It's a little bit more like Night Living Dead in that aspect, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It looks, it has a bigger budget than Dawn of the Dead, but it doesn't look like it, except, you know, in the effects.
The gore looked a lot better.
Yeah, but it's scaled down to a point where you basically feels claustrophobic.
I think around that time period... This was Tom Savini's at his best, really, because, you know, they had so many awesome gore scenes and effect scenes. You know, one of my favorites is the very beginning. You see the tongue zombie with the basically missing the bottom jaw, and I just really love that. I think it's like what they call it, animatronics.
Yeah, it is. It's just an animatronic head.
Or something.
And I'll tell you what's funny about that scene to me now is that somebody actually asked us if we would interview that guy, you know, that we should get him to be a guest.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the thing about it is that you need to realize that that's not a real guy.
That's a compliment to to those guys, because that movie is 20 years old.
Yeah, it is.
And it still looks...
You know, even Nicotero says this. He says that, you know, as far as a lot of the bite scenes in the film and a lot of the gore scenes, you can't still to this day find another film that's that good.
Yeah.
And it's character-wise, too, and this is the reason why I think it took so long, because that film actually has a huge cult following now, but in the beginning people hated it because it wasn't Dawn of the Dead, was, you know, the characters in the film all have a life of their own. They're not... typical 2D characters. They're all really good. Like, Gary Clark's character's good. Joe Pilato's character's awesome in the film. And Lori Cardell's got a strong character. And Bub, even. Yeah. I think one of the things that makes that film work so well is that that's the ultimate zombie. You know, Bub is one that takes on, you know, human characteristics. And
he did, like, a really good... Sherman Howard did a really good job in that because, you know, as you know, he really couldn't say anything other than mumble a few lines here and there, which is supposed to be the first zombie that ever talked, which you'll hear a little bit later in the little Gary Clark clip that I cut up. Yeah, but he did a really good job in that he controlled all of his emotions just in his facial features and stuff that was used a lot in old movies like Buster Keaton silent movies, and he used a lot of those old acting, silent movie acting, I guess is what you would call it.
As far as performance-wise goes, I know people constantly bitch about that movie and the over-the-top and so, but it's just like Gary Clark said in the interview we did with him. It wouldn't have worked if they hadn't done it that way. Yeah. Because you got to think about the plot of the film is, you know, they basically are driven almost insane. They kind of have to act like that, yeah. Like they're over-the-top crazy because they live in a freaking bunker 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
But I think what Romero was leading up to with that film, more so than anything, because it starts with Judith O'Day's character in the first, in Night of the Living Dead, as being completely, you know, hysterical when the plague breaks out. It leads to Fran in Dawn of the Dead, Galen Ross's character, mm-hmm. being kind of strong but yet feminine, you know, not really. Lori Cardell in Day of the Dead being too strong. I think that was what he was making. What happens if, you know, you're too cool about everything going on around you? If you're so calm that you don't notice that all this shit's happening.
You ever notice this, too? And for some reason, I've never mentioned this to you, I don't think. The opening scenes in Dawn and Day of the Dead are almost identical.
Oh, yeah. They're both, like, back shots of one of them's of Gavin Ross sleeping and the other one's of Lori Cardell with her head between her legs. Yeah. I hadn't actually thought about that, but I guess that's true.
Yeah. Day of the Dead, honestly, I think it's probably the movie I've seen the most out of all of them. I don't know why that is. But I know back in the day it was shown on HBO constantly.
Yeah, it was. Well, they both were back in the day. But if Dawn of the Dead is about consumerism, which you know it basically is, then Day of the Dead is about the powers that be. It's about military and government and how things break down when people don't work together. I think that was the main point of Day of the Dead.
Yeah. But if we go to the way the zombies look, I know the zombies in Dawn of the Dead, so Annie mentioned they had gray makeup, which really looked sort of bluish-green, and that has to do with the lighting. I know I'm not a big makeup effects guy, but I know that has something to do with the lighting. The zombies in Day of the Dead by far look the best of any of the original trilogy, at least.
Yeah, he had a lot more money to work with on that film. Yeah. And I think he by that time, learned a lot of tricks and perfected the craft more so than, you know.
There was a lot more squibs. There was a lot more appliances, I guess you would call them.
Yeah.
That they put on. I know they have the featured zombies, which had all kinds of added appliances that had, you know. And they were all painted like this really lime green color and that. And I thought it really worked well.
And he... You know, you got to think of the people that he had behind him. He had Nick Terrell behind him at that point in time, too. And he hired a lot of people that knew a lot more about what they were doing than was so in Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, I think, didn't Howard Berger work on that movie, too?
I think he did for a limited time.
I know also Mike Tursik.
Yeah, who plays the eviscerated zombie in the film, too.
If you remember, he's the one that raises his arm up and guts falls all out on the floor and it makes Lori Cardell vomit almost. Yeah, that guy's really went on to be an amazing sculptor, and I think he designed the dinosaurs and stuff for Jurassic Park, so that should tell you something. I mean,
Nick
Savini can definitely find all these effects artists. I mean, he definitely found all those guys.
You're going to talk about Nicotero and Berger. They both went on to form K&B, which basically does the effects for every horror film that comes out.
Any effects that's left now that CGI can't do, they do it pretty much.
But that was the big thing, I think, that a lot of people know about Day of the Dead. And you got to keep in mind, too, that in between Dawn and Day of the Dead. The Italian splatter cinema stuff took off like crazy. I mean, you had tons of films coming out by, like, you know, Fulci and Mattei and Lindsay and all these people that were basically just, no offense, but they were basically copying the fucking format.
Well, Fulci copied Zombie, okay? That was a ripoff. Zombie was a ripoff.
And Jesus, you Bruno, know Hell of the Living Dead was the biggest ripoff I've ever seen.
Hell of the Living Dead, Bruno Mattei, right?
Yeah.
That's a ripoff right down to the SWAT team.
Yeah.
Uniforms and stuff like that. But
the one thing that I think that, more so than anything, that they latched onto was the effects. That's, yeah. I mean, Savini's splatter effect. If you notice that all of Fulci's movies after that, after Dawn, were just flat-out gore-fest, basically. You know, most anybody...
And I think all that shit was at its height in 1985 when Day of the Dead came out. I mean...
So, basically, Savini had a lot to trump. He had a lot to, you know, work up to with that film.
He had basically had to make the ultimate splatter movie, zombie movie. He had to trump himself tenfold from Dawn of the Dead because there was... Hey, honestly... And I know some people might disagree with me on this, but after Dawn of the Dead came out, Giannotto
DeRossi
from Zombie 2, Fulci's zombie movie, the zombies in that kicked the shit out of Dawn of the Dead zombies. And that only came out maybe a year after Dawn of the Dead. And I'm sorry, but it did. So basically, they had to make those zombies look great in Day of the Dead.
Yeah, but see, the thing about, I think, that makes Zombie different from Dawn of the Dead is there's not that many zombies. I mean,
well, yeah.
You had a small
feature. Yeah, there's not as many.
I mean, Savini had to basically spray paint some of the bitches to get all the people
and
that
it does look like it. Yeah. There's a few great zombies in Dawn of the Dead. I really thought Scott Reiniger's zombie looked really cool.
That's one of the coolest parts of that movie, yeah.
And the airport zombie... was really cool. The bald guy that was featured on the poster, too. But back to Day of the Dead.
And the thing you notice about Day of the Dead, this is the last time this happens in Romero's Dead film, is all those people were from Pittsburgh. All the actors that Romero got
from
Pittsburgh.
I know Chef Brockett from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was a zombie in that movie. Because I listened to the commentary and they were talking about that. And how fucking hilarious is that?
That is hilarious. And, I think the dean of Carnegie Mellon University was a zombie in that movie. Just people you would never expect would even know what that is. Apparently, you know, in Pittsburgh, that's a huge deal to have anything to do with a Romero movie.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we've talked about Day of the Dead long enough.
Yeah, but we did incorporate Dawn of the Dead and tried to incorporate Night of the Dead into it, too, so.
Yeah. So, we'll go to a short clip of the Gary Clore interview right now. And after that, we'll talk about the time between 1985 to 2005 and what happened there, I guess. So enjoy this short clip, the lost clip that was from 3 or 4 weeks ago, of Gary Clore here on DeadBeat.com.
You know, the great story about Tom, and Tom will attest to this, Tom, I, and Gregor, we have a little thing. I got to find this for you. We do the Danny Thomas Coffee Spit School of Acting. That's number one. If you ever see him, drop that one on him. Say, could you teach me the Danny Thomas Coffee Spit? But I remember about 15 years ago, I was walking down Broadway, and I was up at about 52nd Street on Broadway. And I know, you know, New York, you got to watch out because you never know who's around you. I mean, we take it for granted, but there's a lot of zany, crazy people in New York. And I get about a block and a half away from maybe, well, let's say I was at 52nd, so I was heading down to 50th, 49th, got to grab the subway. Anyway, there's a guy walking up towards me. And, you know, Tom Savini used to do a lot of David Letterman.
Yeah.
And right after one of those appearances, which meant he had to be in New York, I'm walking downtown, and there's this guy walking up about a block and a half from me. And I see him stop as I continue to walk. And I can't quite make out who it is. Now, this is how you develop relationships with people. It tells you about the experience of working with George, Tom, me, Greg, Joe, Lori, all of us. Mm-hmm. This guy takes off at a full sprint towards me. Now I'm going. yards away, I realize it's that fucking lunatic Savini. When he gets 10 feet from me, and he will bear this out, he takes a flying leap in the air and lays his body out sideways, knowing that I would do what?
Catch him, I would hope.
You got it, I did.
Imagine if you didn't. No. I mean, that's some pretty, that's some trust right there.
Yeah, it comes through the work and knowing people.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of knowing your personality. If I was a different kind of person, he wouldn't have done that to Bob.
Mm.
Matter of fact, I don't think he would have done to anybody else but me. You know, in terms of day, I've done 24 feature films. You know, I've done 2 Broadway shows, countless other stuff, yada, yada, yada. I will tell you that working with and for George Romero was as good, if not better, than any experience I've ever had in front of the camera. And I still say that Day is the best film. Well, of now, what do you call it? Now there's more, right?
Yeah, it's quadrilogy now.
Quadrilogy. I still think it's the best film of the quadrilogy. And I will tell you something. I do hear from dead fans. And you know what they tell me? I don't know if you've heard this. I went to the premiere. I liked the movie. And I was there. And it's a different film. And a lot of people, hardcore fans, don't like it as much as they.
You mean Land?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's no question for me, really.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, there's more money. They finally gave George more money because he's always had a beg, borrow, and steal for it. Don't ask me why. And they shot it in Toronto. And it's a wonderful cast. I mean, come on. You had John Leguizamo, you had Dennis Hopper. I mean, you had to pay to get some of these people.
Yeah.
And you could see it on the screen. But I'll tell you what, I have talked to hardcore fans. A lot of them really kind of look cool on the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have heard that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're kind of on the fence with that movie, too, I think.
Yeah. It's a different movie. It's a different kind of a movie. And I will tell you just one thing to think about. And I've thought about this. If you have an answer, and I'm missing something, I want you to tell me. If Bub is the getting of knowledge, you understand what I mean for the zombie world?
Yeah.
If Bub is the getting of knowledge, why isn't Eugene's character in Land more advanced?
Yeah, that is kind of true because Bub could actually speak, and I don't think that Eugene Clark speaks.
No, he grunts and he groans and
yeah.
But watch what I'm really saying. And again, Eugene's wonderful. I know Eugene. My point is there a little flaw there in the fourth movie, which should go from night, go to dawn, go to day. But Bub is the first real, true getting of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't Eugene's character be even beyond that?
You think,
yeah. I may be missing it. No, I could be wrong. But that's why I think it's a different movie.
Yeah.
It's a different movie.
To be honest, too, about that movie, I can't help but think that getting people that actually are named, like Dennis Hopper, people like
right.
that, kind of hurt that film.
Well, I got a lot of people tell me that. And I know Dennis. I worked for months with Dennis on a film. And great actor. And, you know, oh boy, God, he's still alive. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Especially the way he's lived his life. But I mean, he's also settled down a lot now. Man, as a young man, he was a wild man. I mean, I worked with him. He was a trip to work with. Great actor. Great actor. I mean, that whole era of James Dean, he knew him. They bowed. I mean, great stuff. But John Leguizamo, I loved him. I thought he was great.
Yeah.
I love Leguizamo. And,
but I don't know why, but I just can't help but think that one of the reasons why those three films and the trilogy work so well together is because...
Hey, you know why? Because you're not looking at stars.
Yeah, he didn't have a budget. I think that's why they worked.
Yeah.
He didn't have
well, no, I, and you know what? I think that's a real valid point. I think it is a valid point. You're not busy looking at a celebrity or something. You're looking at the whole. You're looking at the whole, you know?
Yeah.
And it's people. It's people. It's everyday common people put into a situation. It's not a movie star put into a situation. It's going to be very interesting. That's why I asked you guys. If you know, and it doesn't seem like you do because I don't, who's going to be in this supposed remake of Day?
No, basically
I know you do.
Yeah.
On October 20th through 22nd, 2006, in Racine, Wisconsin, it is It came from Lake Michigan, Wisconsin's only horror film festival. All independent filmmakers nationwide are welcome to participate in. It came from Lake Michigan, with special guests including Lloyd Kaufman, Fred Olen Ray, Brink Stevens, Debbie Rochon, Susie Lorraine, Jason Paul Cullum, Scott Goldberg, and many more. Be sure to check out It Came From Lake Michigan.com, or it might just come for you.
Welcome back to the Detrospective here at Debit.com. I'm Uncle Bill again.
I'm the Crip Kentuckian again to you.
And now we move to the period of time between Day and Land of the Dead, which is probably one of my favorite periods, not because of Romero's films, because he didn't really have any, he didn't have a dead film in between that period of time, but because it was the period of time that nurtured what a lot of people call the camcorder Coppolas, which were low-budget, you know, innovative, independent filmmakers that got inspired from Romero's Dead trilogy. This is when you had everybody come out of the woodwork. You had J.R. Buchwalter start, you know, coming out. You had Todd Sheets coming out of Kansas City, I think. You know, you had just Jason Paul Cullum coming out. And even around that time, Peter Jackson, you know.
Yeah, not long after that.
In New Zealand. So yeah. It was great because all these people grew up, or at one point in their time, you know, had a real affinity for the Dead movies, and they made some of the most, you know, classic zombie movies that we still talk about today, aside from Romero.
Yeah.
Now, the best thing I can say about that is that, and also around that time, is when Return of the Living Dead came out, which was John Russo, you know, kind of had a credit in writing that film too, I think.
Russ Streiner too.
Yeah, but it was just, there were so many great zombie films that came out at that time, and it was all due to Romero. And you know, this is a Romero special. It's May of the Dead, of course. So we would be remiss not to talk about everybody that, you know, was influenced by him that made some of the films that we still watch to this day. So there was,
yeah, because if you think about it, look at Peter Jackson, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he made Dead Alive, which is...
Yeah.
It's one of the most hilarious movies you'll ever see.
It's like the epitome of splatter. Yeah. I don't think anything will ever top that movie.
And look at where he's at now.
Exactly. Well, look at Sam Raimi, too. I mean, Sam Raimi came out in 82, I think.
Yeah, but was still, it was after Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
And look at where he's at now.
Yeah. But moving on to Land of the Dead, which is a good 10 years...
Yeah, and there was a lot. I know Romero had a big problem getting that movie made, getting the movie he wanted made. There were many names for it. I know Dead Reckoning was one of the names for it. You mentioned
Twilight of the Dead.
Twilight of the Dead was one.
At one time, I'd heard that it was going to be Diamond Dead or something like that.
Well, that's a new one that they're working on right now, but yeah, I don't know if it'll ever be made.
I think somebody just made that up, to be honest. even what they're talking about doing with the musical and stuff. But there was so much build-up for this movie, for CK and I, at least, I know, because when you grew up watching all these movies, we never thought we'd get to see one in the theater in our lifetime, you know, and Land of the Dead was that movie. And it was also a studio movie. There's no other way that you can...
If you're being honest here, what finally got that Land of the Dead out in theaters, and it's unfortunate but it's true, is a movie a couple years before called 28 Days Later did really, really well at the box office. Then you had the Resident Evil movies that did really, really well at the box office.
Yep.
Then, in 2004, they did the Dawn of the Dead remake.
Yep.
Universal did that. So it was inevitable they were going to let George Romero make or direct another zombie movie. I don't know how much of this movie was straight from Romero or how much of it was toned down. I don't know if he toned any of it down. But as far as the splatter aspects of it, there really weren't as much as, and I really didn't expect them to be as much as Dawn or Day of the Dead.
Yeah, there's no way you can't get away with that stuff anymore, especially if you have a movie that was rated R. And, you know, in Romero's defense, if he wanted to get this movie out to anybody nowadays, you have to have an R rating. They just don't, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably no theaters left that'll play NC-17 movie.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is it is a studio movie, and it...
And studio movies have to look a certain way.
Yeah, and I can't help but think
which is unfortunate, but...
I know he would probably never cop to this, but I can't help but think that he was influenced to make that movie a certain way.
Yeah.
That the powers that be basically dictated a lot of that movie.
And I can understand, you know, some of the CG, I can understand them using that, but for some reason they chose to use CG instead of the squibs for the gunshots, which is really bad choice because the CG in Land of the Dead, as far as the gunshots go, looked really, really bad, I thought. I mean, it just didn't fit with the movie.
It looks really bad in general throughout the whole movie. There's a lot of scenes like the zombie that doesn't have, or that has his head attached to his spine and flips it over.
Yeah.
It's, Jesus. I mean, you can tell that, you know, even now that looks outdated. It's not even been, you know, a year.
Yeah.
But I guess the whole point of Land of the Dead, to me anyway, is it's hugely political. You can just tell that it has a lot to do with the Bush administration and the fact that Romero thought that the Bush administration was basically just ignoring the problem until it bit him on the ass.
Yeah, and here I was watching this the other night, and I was thinking of this, okay? George Bush is Dennis Hopper, right?
Supposedly, yeah.
All of the wealthy, you know, citizens live in Fiddler's Green.
Yeah.
The middle-class citizens work for the people at Fiddler's Green, but they aren't allowed to live with them.
Mm-hmm.
The low-class citizens are zombies.
Exactly, yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
That was the point of the film. And to me, it's just saying that...
Which is pretty cool. I mean, if anything about that movie, that is pretty cool way he set that up, actually.
The zombies are almost like a revolution because, you know, the soldiers, they come into their areas, you know, where they live.
Yeah.
And they kill all of them. And finally, they start to realize, or at least one of them starts to realize, you know, the Big Daddy zombie played by Eugene Clark starts to realize that this is wrong somehow, and he kind of organizes them all together, and they go and attack Fiddler's Green in the movie. And that's basically the whole plot of the movie, is just the zombies coming to kind of morph and evolve into something else and kind of organize and then attack the people in the film. And that's that's pretty political in and of itself, you know.
Yeah.
Basically saying that what's going to eventually happen is that people are, you know, because they had the fireworks scene where the zombies were distracted by the fireworks all the time. And finally, at the end of it, it doesn't work anymore. And that's basically just saying that, you know, right now...
You can only distract them for so long.
Yeah, you can only distract people for so long, and they finally wake up and realize that they're being screwed, and then they revolt, which is what happened in the film. And, yeah, the script...
And I can't help but think that Land of the Dead is probably one of those movies that you're just going to have to watch a few times before you completely get it, and before it actually... You actually think it's probably going to grow on you a little bit, actually.
I love the script of the movie. I right now I can say that I think that was great.
Yeah.
It's just the execution that I hate. It's the way that it looks and the CG in it and everything else that...
Well, I got to tell you, though, I like the way the zombies looked in it. I thought that was some of the best looking...
Yeah, well, Nicotero is a big part of that because, you know, the zombies look great.
The number 9 zombie... you know, the female baseball player zombie.
Yeah.
You also got the butcher, which looked pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you got some awesome animatronic zombies that they used that I thought looked freaking unbelievable.
The one that bites John Leguizamo is really awesome. But, see, in between that, though, here's the problem I have.
Now, I'll tell you where they messed up, okay?
Well, with the big studio thing,
Big Daddy shouldn't have been the leader, okay? Because he didn't have a gimmick, really.
Well, Eugene Clark...
And he didn't have a cool look to him, either, like Bub did.
Eugene Clark, I watched that movie, you know, a bunch of times, and I try to find something about his portrayal to like. But that was horrible, man. That all he did was just scream and grunt, and there was no real emotion like there was with Bubba. Yeah. I thought that was a piss poor portrayal, and I still will think that, you know, when I watched the movie. But where I think they messed up the most in that movie was with the big studio, like with everything else that they do in studios right now, you have to have names. You have to have recognition.
Yeah.
So you get douchebags like John Leguizamo, and you get people like Simon Baker, who I thought did a shitty job.
Who was actually in The Ring 2, which is, oh my God. If you ever heard us mention that movie is beyond horrible.
But, you know, Romero didn't have anything to do with these people, I guarantee, before this movie. You know, everybody else used to come from Pittsburgh. They were known in the acting circle.
Yeah, that's just the thing, though. I mean, you're dealing with a big-name studio. You have to get people that they think will draw money, which, what has Dennis Hopper been in lately that would, I mean, I don't understand that. And Simon Baker's not a big name, really.
No.
John Leguizamo's never really been a hit movie.
The only person in that film that had any business being there was Asia Argento.
Yeah.
And that's just
I did like that, actually.
You know, but you can just tell that it's just another paycheck. They don't believe, at least to me, the actors look like they don't believe in the movie. They don't even know what the hell they're doing there. You know, they're just kind of running through the motions and stuff.
Yeah. One zombie that did look piss poor, too, was John Leguizamo's zombie.
Oh, yeah.
He looked like a zombie of, like, Michael Jackson or something.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
But I, you know, I'll still say that Land of the Dead was a pretty good movie to come out in the year 2005.
Just like Day of the Dead following Dawn of the Dead. You couldn't follow that series, I don't think, today without disappointing a lot of people.
I mean, the complete genre has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Since then.
But, yeah, as far as movies coming out today, it was a great movie for that time period. I think I put it right up there with the Devil's Rejects and High Tension. Yeah, it came out that year.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've talked long enough about Land of the Dead. We'll finish off the Tom Savini interview, part two of the Tom Savini interview. And he unveiled some pretty shocking things in this last part, to say the least.
And I'll be real honest, when we were doing this interview, I couldn't fucking believe some of the stuff that he was saying. I mean, I was laughing my ass off because I just knew how this was going to go over for a lot of people. But you have to, you know, listen to it for yourself.
Yeah, just check that out. Part two of the Tom Savini interview here on DeadBitch.com.
In around 82, you got to work with Romero again on Creepshow. And I was just wondering, too, because I was wondering what it was like to work with Stephen King, because I know he was involved with that film as well.
Well, he's just a brilliant, he's like a 13-year-old kid, you know, but that's a grown-up, and he's, I mean, he was just a lot of fun. He had lots of stories, and when you, I mean, you know, I gave him a copy of Fluffy the Crate Creature, and he kept it on top of his word processor for years, and, you know, because he writes 1,500 words a day, you know, and he's just brilliant. I read his stuff faithfully, and he's just a brilliant writer. But to work with him, I mean, he disappeared one day from the Creepshow set, and I was going to a store to buy some supplies, and I was driving up the highway, and here comes Stephen King walking on the median strip in the middle of the highway, drinking a bottle of Perrier and reading a book. You know, so it wasn't a surprise to me when he got hit by that van.
Yeah.
You know, because I know that I saw him walking right down the middle of the highway. You know, he could have been killed that day.
Yeah.
So I picked him up. We went to the store, you know, and that was all great. And then, you know, we had dinner lots of times, and I went to visit him on the set of Maximum Overdrive, and I've been to his house, and we were going to produce some things a while back, but then, you know, it just never happened. And I met him, the first time I met him was on Knight Riders, you know.
Yeah. I guess we can go on to Day of the Dead. We were curious how long the preparation that was for the makeup effects.
For Day of the Dead, we had a long preparation on that. I remember that my crew was at my house, and we would start off every day just making up, pouring foam latex into all the generic zombie molds that we had. And we would do this every day. And then, you know, we were preparing certain things in the script that I knew I was going to have done, you know, at my house. And that was like for a month or two. And then we moved into the studio and set up a workshop there and continued doing that. So we had hundreds of zombie appliances ready for when the zombies came in. If you walked in, we'd look at you and say, all right, you're a medium, and we'd give you, like, put medium appliances on you and a medium set of teeth, and off you went. You were a zombie, you know. But then we spent 2 months in a mine, underground in that mine, and we never saw the sun. I mean, we'd go in at, like, 6 in the morning, come out at 7 at night in the wintertime, and, you know, we didn't see the sun for, like, 2 months.
Yeah, we talked to Lori Cardill about that, and she said that a lot of people on the set got sick. I don't know if you ever got sick.
No, I never got sick, but you could. I mean, when you were there, the mine was always 55 degrees, and if you blew your nose or coughed, it would come out black. You know, you just breathing, or whatever the hell was down there, but you were breathing it, you know. And, never got sick, but and I don't remember other people getting sick, although I'm sure they did, you know.
Yeah. I was just curious about the design for the zombie bug in the film. Was there anything particularly that inspired that?
Not really. I mean, we knew we had to make him up almost every day because he was like a recurring character. So we made it a one-piece appliance and just made him wrinkled and kind of a low-browed, dumb-looking guy, you know?
And I guess during that time, too, this is where did you meet Greg Nicotero on the set of the film, or had you met him before?
I met George, I think, on Creepshow. Greg was visiting the set. He was just a young kid then, you know, in medical school. And he dropped out of medical school to assist me on Day of the Dead. And Day of the Dead, I think, was first. Day of the Dead was first. And then he was my assistant on Monkey Shines. And after that, he formed his own company. We went to L.A., and then shortly after that, formed his own company. But I've known him since he was 14.
So did you basically, like, tutor him? Were you, like, a teacher to him, or did he just come on?
Well, I think it wasn't so much a tutoring thing as a learn by example, learn by watching us, you know. I mean, we had some pretty talented guys on the crew, and, you know, Greg was always interested in that stuff. And he was already an artist. He was a sketch artist, you know, so it was pretty easy for him to pick the stuff up. And, I'm doing a movie with Greg right now in Texas called Grindhouse.
Yeah.
It's a Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez movie. And I go back down on June 1st to shoot, and then we're all finished in July. And then Quentin Tarantino starts his movie. It's a double feature. It's two movies in one.
Yeah, we've heard lots of things about the film, that the production was halted, and is everything pretty much on track? Or?
Yeah, we went on a hiatus for a little bit. We had some... Well, the director got sick, actually, Robert. But he's well now, and we were going to shut down, and Quentin was going to start his movie. But they decided that, you know, now that Robert is well, that we would just continue his. And so we do. We're going to start again May 31st until around July 10th, and then Quentin will start his movie.
Cool. That sounds good. I guess we'll go on to the Night of the Living Dead remake. How were you approached to direct that, and did you ever see yourself as a director before?
I already directed three episodes of Tales from the Dark Side, the TV series that George was involved in. And George came up to me one day and he said, I just got the green light to do a remake of Night of the Living Dead. So I thought, great, I'm going to get to do the effects finally. I didn't get to do the original movie, so I'm going to be able to do the effects on this remake. He said, no, I want you to direct it. So, wow. So, but it was the worst experience of my life, you know, directing that movie. I still have nightmares where I'm on the set of that movie directing. And
yep.
It wasn't a pleasant experience. Well, George wasn't there for one thing. You know, he was in Florida writing The Dark Half. That was part of his commitment that he had to take care of. And that left me with a bunch of idiots. And people who I thought were my friends just turned out to be just real backstabbing liars. And I learned a big lesson on that movie about people and loyalty and friendship, you know. I'm always that way, but you don't get it back sometimes.
Yeah. It seems to me in the last couple of years that the film has kind of gotten a bit of a following more
than
it did when it came out.
Oh, I know. Now people just love that movie. It's a cult classic. It's interchangeable in the trilogy of Night, Dawn, and Day, and I get a lot of fan mail about that movie. But it's kind of ironic because I hate the movie. It's not. I only got to do maybe, I don't know, 20% of what I wanted to do. And it's lucky that anything is up there on the screen. But people like it, so. But it does, I mean, my stuff is definitely in there, my ideas and everything, you know. It's just not all of them, not enough of them that I thought would make a good movie.
Yeah, I've noticed since pretty much the early 90s, right around when you made that, the MPAA really restricted a lot of what we used to see in horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that hurt that film and the genre in general?
Hell yeah. I don't think it hurt the genre, but it hurt that film. I mean, when they got a movie with George Romero's name on it and my name on it, I mean, they were just gunning for us. They just couldn't wait to get their hands on that. And it was a small film, a low budget. And, you know, the big budget movie got away with it because they contribute to the MPAA, you know, but a small film like that didn't have a chance. You know, so it turned out to be a pretty sterile movie. I mean, if you watch the DVD and see all the behind-the-scenes stuff, you saw that it was a much juicier, grislier film, you know, before the MPAA got their hands on it.
Curious about, and we've asked everybody that was associated with the original Day of the Dead this question, but have you been approached anything about the remake?
No. Mm-mm.
Oh, okay.
I haven't been approached about the remake of Day of the Dead. I haven't been approached with the remake of Creepshow. I wasn't approached with the, I think it's going to be a remake of Friday the 13th somewhere.
Yeah,
you hear all these rumors, you know.
Yeah.
One quick question about Dario Argento. I know you work with him on Trauma and Two Evil Eyes.
Yeah.
We've never had the chance to ask anybody this, but what is he like as a director and a person in general?
Well, he's, we had a great time. He doesn't speak very much English. And I don't speak Italian anymore. I spoke Italian as a kid. I had to learn English, and I had forgotten it. But we would communicate for hours just with sign language and gestures, you know, about the effects. And he wound up calling me the volcano of the mind in Italian, you know. I wish I could remember how it goes, you know. Dario is a dream. He's a prince. I miss him a lot.
I hadn't had a chance to ask you this, but you also had the opportunity to work with Tobe Hooper on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Yeah.
And how was he?
Well, Tobe was great because we smoked the same cigars, Monte Cristo. He would, and they're Cuban, and you can't get them in the States. They have to come through a diplomatic pouch or illegally, you know. But he gave me a box of Monte Cristos right off the bat, which was great. And then, he smoked Monte Cristos like cigarettes. He'd throw them away like when they were 5 inches long, and they were still worth about, you know, $10, you know, then. But he was great. He was he loved the effects that we come up with, and he let us do what we wanted to do. And I have great respect for him because he only had 1 week to prepare Texas Chainsaw 2, coming right from Invasion from Mars, you know, Invaders from Mars. Mm. So I have a lot. And, we do conventions together, and we've been on talk shows and stuff together. I think I invited him to the midnight showing of One Night of the Living Dead premiered at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood, and he came, you know, so we support each other.
I was just curious because effects-wise, I really like that film a lot.
Which one?
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Yeah.
I think the designs in that film are some of the best ones.
Well, the set was incredible, yeah. Kerry White's set was wonderful, and I had a great crew. We did some wonderful stuff. The effects all stayed in there. Except the parking garage stuff, the second unit stuff. They cut all that stuff for some reason. The movie was released unrated. They could have left all that in.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you were at all nervous in stepping into that series because, you know, the first film had already pretty much been legendary by that time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the second film was not a remake of the first film. It was a continuation, so... You know, I'm never nervous about that stuff. I always look forward to what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, I always have this thing where I can't wait to see what's going to happen. And that eliminates any nervousness or stage fright. You know, when I went off and did Dusk Till Dawn, I was going to be doing scenes with George Clooney and Harvey Keitel, you know. And, I mean, it would be natural to have stage fright, but my attitude really was, I can't wait to see what comes out of me, or I can't wait to see what happens. and that eliminates the stage fright, you know, and it made it fun to be there.
Since it is, we're talking about Romero throughout this whole month, I was just curious where you think George ranks among the other classic directors like Carpenter, Craven, and Wynton.
Well, I think he's way above Carpenter and Clive Barker. Clive Barker, yeah, I don't really like his movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, Romero is, he's above. Well, yeah, I had dinner with George and John Carpenter at George's apartment once, you know, and I like Carpenter. I loved The Thing. You know, I think that's one of my, the only good movies I think that he did. I mean, Halloween I thought was stupid. The first scene you see is the point of view of the killer looking at the girl in the dresser, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's from 7 feet high, looking down at the girl. And then they cut outside and show you a kid that's the killer. I thought they were trying to fool us because the kid was only 3 feet tall. And the point of view of the killer was 7 feet tall. So that was a big mistake to me. Now, don't forget, I was in effects mode. I judge movies by the effects.
Yeah.
So that started right off as being stupid to me. I mean, Halloween, people will tell you Halloween is the greatest movie ever made. It's a classic, blah, 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 blah. But I just thought it was dumb. I mean, there was a couple of dumb things in there. When he stabs the guy against the kitchen wall, the guy stays upright, and you know, and he would have fallen over the point of the knife where the knife hit him, and where the knife pinned him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So all these things were effects mistakes to me that I guess other people, it wasn't important to them, but it ruined the movie for me. But The Thing was a masterpiece of splatter, I think. And that was because of Rob Bottin's effects, you know. So I guess to answer your question, George ranks, George is up there. I mean, George is, you know, George is quite the artist, and he's a master editor, and those things are what make a director good, you know.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Rob Bottin, and on the set of The Thing, I've read that he basically had a nervous breakdown because he worked so hard on the effects in that movie. And I was just curious, what was the most challenging, you know, film you ever worked on?
Well, I never heard that Rob Bottin had a nervous breakdown on that set.
He basically worked himself into exhaustion, I think.
Well, I'm sure that happened because any artist, when an artist works on something, an artist is never finished. An artist can never be finished. You will always continue working on something. The reason you stop is because of a deadline, you know, and it's due on the set, or it's, you know, it's time to be published or something, you know. So Rob is, he works his ass off. He's a workaholic. So I would believe that he put himself into exhaustion on that movie because there was so much stuff and so such brilliant stuff, you know. But what was your question? Oh, what was the most taxing movie I ever worked on?
Uh-huh.
Probably Creepshow, because it was five little movies, and it was just me and, you know, my 17-year-old assistant, and we did all that stuff, you know. But I don't think back on it as exhausting. I think on it as being just a blast, you know, the most fun you could have, standing up. You know, although I do remember when they called rap, I was very happy that it was over, that I could now get back to my normal life and not have to worry about what's due tomorrow, you know?
Yeah. You've pretty much taken hiatus from the effects business right now. I don't think you've... Are you trying to concentrate more on acting and directing now?
Well, that's what I do. I don't do effects anymore.
Oh.
I am concentrating on acting and directing. But I still get effects jobs like crazy, and I turn them all over to my school.
Oh.
And my students go off and do them, which is good for the school, it's good for the students, and it's good for producers' budgets. Producers out there who have some, you know, low-budget film they want to get done, and they can certainly afford my students, and they're getting, you know, top-quality, great work, you know. But I've directed a pilot for a TV series called The Chill Factor, and we're trying to get more episodes of that off the ground. And I'm acting. I did a movie in New York called Sea of Dust, and now I'm doing Quentin Tarantino's new movie, Robert Rodriguez's new movie, Grindhouse. So if you're going to make a change like that, if you're going to stop, if you don't want to do effects anymore and make a change like I want to, then you got to just quit and concentrate on what you want to do. And so far it's working.
You had cameos in the Dawn of the Dead remake, and you were in Land of the Dead too, briefly. What do you think about remakes in general? Do you think they're getting out of hand now?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of criticism about that. Definitely Hollywood have any original ideas, but they're remaking one old thing after another. I mean, The Omen is coming out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the preview to that, and I know that the movie is just going to be the same movie, but just handled differently as far as the effects, and now that they have the technology for CGI. I mean, the remake of King Kong, thank God they made that, you know. I mean, that's the new King Kong. And it's much better than the original is still a classic. I will always watch it. I will always enjoy it. But some sequels or some remakes are great. Some suck, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my friends give me criticism when I talk about the remake of Psycho with, what's his name?
Vince Vaughn,
yeah. I mean, I like that movie a lot because it's quite a chore to try to remake a movie like that, a classic. You know, and I thought he did a great job, and my friends laugh at me, you know, they hated it, you know, but I loved it. But there are some miserable remakes out there, of course, you know, we can all name 10 of them if we wanted to, you know. I think that when you hear somebody doing a remake, well, you give it a chance. And you give it a chance by watching it and either liking it or not, you know. It gives people work.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're better than the original. So I'm all for it.
Yeah, it doesn't appear to be going anywhere anyway, so.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I still like the original ideas.
Uh-huh.
Some remakes are exact copies of the original, and they're boring because of that. I'm hoping that Night of the Living Dead, mine, wasn't because most of it is exactly like the same, the first movie, but then, you know, I turned Barbara into a hero instead of a, you know, a mindless twit that she was in the first movie, you know.
Did you hear they were remaking that again? The
Which
three
one?
Viewers?
The Not Living Dead.
Oh, that's right, and Sid Haig is in it, I think.
Yeah.
I did hear about that, yeah. I mean, you know, but the remake of Day of the Dead, I hear, is a piece of shit.
Oh, Contagion.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think that's the one that's already out.
Yeah, that can't ever be as good as the first one, you know?
No, it's not.
The remake of Creepshow will probably be the same, but who knows until it's done.
So, yeah, I just wanted to ask you, because there's going to be a ton of people that ask about this, your Savini School of Makeup Effects.
Yeah.
And I was just curious if you could kind of tell us about the setup of the programs and stuff.
Well, you know, it's actually the Tom Savini International Special Makeup Effects School. We got students coming from all over the world.
Oh, okay.
Our first student from France is coming in next semester, and it's a 16-month program with a degree. You get an associate's degree in advanced business, and it's cost half of what these other schools charge. Like, we've got students coming in from California, from Florida, where there already are makeup schools. Because they go to those places, and, you know, they walk down their halls and see that they, you know, like Joe Blasco's school, they worked on one movie. And they come to my school, and between my credits and my teacher's credits, you know, if you've seen a movie in the last 20 years, one of us has worked on it, you know, I mean, a horror movie. And the fans are, our classes are huge. We had 72 people come in the last semester. In the last graduating class, there were 11 students who weren't even there because they were already working.
Yeah.
So it's the number one school in the world, as far as my opinion, because, you know, we have Dick Smith joined us.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Dick Smith is the greatest living makeup artist on the planet, you know, and he's associated himself with me and my school.
Now, is this an independent school, or is it run in conjunction with another university?
No, this is it. It's the Douglas Education Center that used to be the Douglas School of Business, and they also have a medical program, and the Tom Savini Special Makeup Effects Program is, you know, part of that now.
Well, can you tell us about any upcoming projects you might have that we haven't mentioned that people might want to know?
Well, the Chill Factor, we're going to do some more episodes with the Chill Factor. The website is still up. You can go and order it from the website, the pilot episode. Grindhouse, which is the movie I'm working on right now with Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez. Sea of Dust, which will be out. Well, I don't know. I'm sure it's going to go right to DVD, but it's sort of a homage to the old Hammer films. You know, it's the same kind of look. You know. Oh yeah, I did a thing in England called Forest of the Damned. That's out. That's out on DVD. I mean, there's lots of contracts. I mean, lots of conversation, no contracts as far as future stuff goes. So I don't even put it in my calendar unless half the money's up front. So I wouldn't even want to pitch those things to you.
Yeah, there's something on here that says that you're going to be directing a movie called The Forest. Is that?
Yeah, it's called The Forsaken Forest.
Oh, okay.
That's the Ilya Salkind company, the guys that did Superman and The Three Musketeers. So we're in talks about me directing that down here in West Virginia, but they're raising money on that internationally to get it to sell it overseas first before we do it, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that could happen any time, so.
Hi, this is Tuesday Night, and you're listening to DeadPit.com.
Welcome back to the DeadPit.com Romero Deadtrospective for me the Dead. And we really just want to thank Tom Savini for spending all that time with us. And, you know, I know that I've been a major fan of his for years, but no more so than old Uncle Bill over here, who's been a lifelong fan of Mr. Savini.
Yeah, and it's no secret that we've talked about on here before about my personal experience with him at convention, but I can honestly say that I can put that behind me now, because you couldn't ask for a nice fucking guy to do an interview with on the phone.
And especially one that has had the experience throughout his career that Tom Savini has had. If you go on his filmography on IMDb, look at all the people he's worked with. I mean, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's harder than hell to do the interview, by the way. While he had all that stuff to talk about, and you knew that you could probably talk to him for 3 hours if you wanted to.
Plus, we had about, not that we're making excuses or anything, because I actually think the interview's pretty fucking killer, but we had about, 3 or 4 hours to actually prepare for the interview?
Yeah, we did.
So
it was one of those last-minute things that
if you want to write in and complain about it, shut the fuck up! We did the best that we could.
Yeah. So I guess closing the show out, we can mention what we have planned for next week, which is, it's not May of the Dead anymore, folks. May of the Dead's over.
Yeah, I'm kind of sad to see it go. That was actually pretty fun.
But we have a rare interview from somebody that really doesn't do interviews about her experience with the horror genre. You've probably heard on the promo, I don't know if you remember who she is, Tuesday Night, who was Kirsten Parker on
Nightmare on Elm Street 4.
Yeah. And this is one of the first interviews she's ever done about her experience on that film. And she also talks about, she's worked with horror luminaries, Jamie Lee Curtis and Tippi Hedren, and she talks about that too. And it's one that we've had a while that for some reason, we just kept putting it off. But it's next week on the show, and we're going to have a lot more stuff to talk about. But before that, I guess we can talk about what's going to be in the future for George Romero and his movies.
Yeah, and there's a ton of stuff that is going on that has to do with remakes and, you know, stuff that he's attached to. And the one that we hear the most about, and nobody can substantiate, I know this because we've asked everybody about it, that has anything to do with Day of the Dead, is the Day of the Dead remake that's supposed to be directed by Steve Miner.
Yeah.
Apparently, nobody that had anything to do with the Dead movies knows anything about this. So,
yeah,
you know, that should tell you something about that project.
Like, it's kind of odd, actually.
Yeah.
And you got the Day of the Dead 2 Contagion pile of shit that came out a couple years ago, which I'm sure Romero's not happy about that. I'm just taking a guess. Mr. Dick Rubenstein seems to fuck over a lot of people. But you've got the Creepshow remake coming out. You've got Creepshow 3 coming out, which I think is from the same folks that did the Day of the Dead 2,
mm-hmm,
the Doodlesons. And I know he's working on, they're in pre-production for the Stephen King film From a Buick 8 the adaptation of that book.
And there's a lot of stuff that's been rumored about this, but I swear to God, I think it has to be some kind of a joke, where it's called Diamond Dead,
yeah.
And he's supposed to be directing it. It's supposed to be a zombie musical of some kind. And that sounds like something Troma would do,
yeah.
More so than it says something like Romero would do. I don't know. We'll see if that how that ever
pans
out.
Yeah, and I know Land of the Dead 2.
Yeah.
That's probably the one thing that will happen soon.
And what's so funny about that, too, is the fact that he gets to make Land of the Dead 2 is that the film didn't do great over here in the theaters.
Yeah, but
When it went on DVD, it really did well. Because, and I think, too, that a lot of the overseas markets, the Italian market and the European market, where, you know, they've been even more looking forward to the Romero's, you know, films, probably, you know, helped that movie a lot more than we'll ever know.
Yeah, so I know all the Romero fans have a lot to look forward to, actually. There's a lot of remakes and stuff like that coming out, which I don't know if it'll be worthwhile, but, hey, we'll watch it because we're fans of Romero.
And I just want to mention that probably more so than anybody else, Romero is my favorite director in horror. And even though we didn't get a chance to interview him personally, although you can't say we didn't try.
We did try, and we'll get into that next week.
Yeah, but, you know, it was just, it was a great thing for me to get to do it anyway. Because
yeah, I mean, and this was really something that's, again, just like the Friday the 13th special that we did when we first started, this is something we really didn't know what it was going to be until it was over. I think that now it's over. That, you know, it's sort of sad.
Yeah, some people want us to continue doing it,
yeah.
And some people tell us to stop doing it because we're taking up too much time. But you know what? Fuck it. It is what it is. You know, it's our tribute in the best way that we can to somebody that we really admire, who is George Romero.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. And I just want to say before we wrap the show up that I want to personally thank, you know, Gary Clark, probably more so than anybody else because he helped us out,
yeah.
More so than anybody else. I want to thank Judith O'Day. I want to thank Lori Cardill. And I definitely want to thank Tom Savini for coming through on the interview last week. You know, and it was awesome. What else can I say?
Also, real quick, I want to thank homepageofthedead.com, arrowinthehead.com, fridaythe13thfilms.com. We want to have the best, very special thanks to Out the Axlish from the message board for helping out a lot. Thanks to the Butcher over at killreviews.com. Thanks for everybody who helped promote this whole month long of May of the Dead, and we deeply, deeply appreciate it. And I hope everybody enjoyed it. And if you're missing the regular format of the show, it will be back next week when we have one of the stars from Nightmare on Elm Street 4 Tuesday night on to talk about her experience on that movie. And we'll tell you a little bit about what our next little venue project is going to be with the Summer of Independence, which we'll clue you in on a little bit more next week.
Yeah, we're still finalizing a lot of stuff about that, but we should get to it soon.
Something completely different from May of the Dead. But for one last time, this is DeadPit.com signing off, finale of May of the Dead.